I'd like now to welcome to the program Ruben Martinez. He's a journalist, performer, musician. He's a professor of writing and literature at Loyola Marymount University. He's the author of several books, the latest of which is Desert America, Boom and Bust in the New Old West. And he will be at Collected Works Bookstore tonight at 6 o'clock right here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much for having me.
So this is a book, a fascinating book. It's part memoir, part history, part journalism, and it's about the American desert from California to Texas. What was the seed for this book? How did you come to the idea of writing it?
Well, the earliest seed is it was in my infancy, because I think I probably gazed upon the desert for the very first time. As soon as my eyes could focus, there was a desert scene in my grandparents' house in the Silver Lake neighborhood of Los Angeles, California, which is not the desert, but there was a beautiful stained glass window in my grandparents' house, a house that was built like back in the 20s, you know, early 30s, beautiful architecture and stylistic touches. And they put in this beautiful stained glass window, and the center of the window was a desert scene. It was a distant view across, you know, a sandy plain with cacti, different kinds of cacti, and a view of distant mountains, you know, tinged with blue in the distance. And this scene, when I was a kid, it just glowed. It was burned into my imagination. And then soon thereafter, I was seeing the actual desert through the window of my parents' red Chevy station wagon en route to cheap vacations in the Colorado desert of Southern California, Palm Springs and points east. And then, of course, I was seeing the desert as a kid because my dad was a country western kind of Mexican-American when he was growing up, listening to the Lone Ranger and Tonto on the radio and seeing John Ford westerns on the silver screen. And he kind of bequeathed that vision of the desert to me. So I would say that, you know, the desert was in me from the very beginning of my life. It was deep in my imagination, and then I was on it. And I think really the book begins with that tension, the tension between how the West, the desert West, is imagined for us, how we imagine it, help imagine it, and what it's like when you're actually, you know, standing on it.
In the book, we see a lot of the dark side of the West, like drug addiction here in northern New Mexico and some of the suffering that goes on at the border. And we see the so-called prosperity and the opportunism and the denial that accompany that. And it seems to me that there aren't really a lot of heroes and villains in the way you tell these stories, but rather just people kind of doing what they do. But at the same time, there's a deep moral center to your work. And I wondered if you could comment on that practice of having a very open mind and a strong moral center at the same time.
Thank you for the wonderful nuanced question about that. I started this project very much identifying with my sympathies were very clear from the beginning. I got into this project wanting to represent the people that have been rendered invisible by the classic old Western representations. Or who were insulted or denigrated, you know, or distorted by the old Western representations. John Ford was a great director of Westerns, and he also faithfully rendered stereotype, you know, in his films. So I wanted to tell a story about the New West, quote unquote, that has been, you know, conjured over the last generation by new Western historians like Patricia Limerick and Richard White and others. So I was very clear that I wanted to bring the people that had been pushed to the margins into the center. But once I was living in the desert, I felt that I couldn't tell the story. I couldn't just be the, quote, voice of the voiceless, because my own position vis-a-vis the people on the margins was very complicated. I was living here, working already as a professor, you know, at the University of Houston. I had means that the people I was writing about didn't. I had, in many ways, more in common with a New York transplant to Santa Fe than I did with either Pueblo peoples living on the Pueblos or the Hispanos of northern New Mexico in the Española Valley. So I felt like, to be honest, I had to represent all sides and my own position in the book. So if there's a moral center to it, it's trying to show that we're all living here at the same time together, and trying to create a moral center through which we can all address these pressing issues of poverty, of addiction, of the great disparity between the one and the 99, which is in such stark relief on this desert landscape.
You lived here in northern New Mexico. You lived in Velarde for several years, and you were surrounded by neighbors, some of whom were selling drugs or using drugs. Some of them were fighting, kind of beating each other up. And everybody seemed to be making you remember that you were an outsider, even though your name is Ruben Martinez, and you're not a gringo, so quote unquote. And you see that society in the context of cultural loss. And I was wondering if you could talk about some of the historical dynamics that make up what is now northern New Mexico society.
Certainly. When I arrived in New Mexico following my then-girlfriend, now my wife, Angela Garcia, who's now at Stanford in the Department of Anthropology and who wrote a book called The Pastoral Clinic about our experience on the same landscape. So they're kind of like the books are intimately related. She's a medical anthropologist, so she was studying addiction in particular, and I was taking a more broad kind of like journalistic look. Angela was writing about the heroin problem, which most of us in northern New Mexico know very well in the Española Valley. And we know that this is a place where there is more heroin addiction, more death by overdose because of heroin than any other place in the United States, rural or urban. And so Angela's work deeply influenced mine, and her vision was that you couldn't look at the heroin problem without looking at the history of dispossession in northern New Mexico and the way it's embodied in such a profound way. I remember within two or three days of arriving in Velarde and in our new house, 125-year-old adobe, we were talking to one of our neighbors. And within 2 minutes of talking to our neighbors, he told us, yeah, I think our family's been here about 10 generations or 11. And a little while later, he said, yeah, we've been here since forever. And it's a refrain that I came to hear again and again, the since forever idea, that our families have been here since forever, that we were part of the land grants, you know, deeded by the various kings of Spain across a few centuries. And that kind of deep historical connection to the land, and put that alongside the even deeper Pueblo connection to the land, gets disrupted, of course, by the Mexican-American War. And then but the real dispossession happens with real estate speculation, the Santa Fe ring, and then the speculation that occurs across the 20th century, including today. We're still buying and selling the land that has such deep roots for both Hispano and Native. We were walking into this landscape of loss, and what's really remarkable to me is that on the one hand, there's a tremendous sense of loss on it, but there's also great resistance, and people have held on. I mean, the land grants, of course, the acreage of the land grants is greatly reduced, but there's still several hundred thousand acres that are held by the original families and the heirs of the original families deed to those lands. And, of course, the Pueblos are still here. So it's loss on the one hand, resistance on the other, And every time a new outsider family comes in, whether it's Ruben Martinez and Angela Garcia, moving into Velarde, or the latest artist from New York, it's kind of a reminder of historical loss, and it spurs resistance. And that resistance is both, it can be violent at times, it can reject the people who come from outside, but it's also given us, it's kept New Mexico history alive.
And of course, I mean, in the one case, there's this painful moment where you were asking your neighbor who's living in a trailer, this was all your family land, what about our house? And he says, I grew up in your house.
Yeah, that was a really key moment, I think, in our process of acclimating to life as outsiders in a tiny agricultural village with such deep Hispano roots. And I have to say that that particular neighbor was the neighbor we got along with the best. But at that in that particular scene that you're relating to me, you know, it's within a couple of months of us arriving there. And he's telling me this across the fence. And when he tells me, you know, that that was the house that he grew up in, and that I'm in the old adobe, the picturesque adobe, you know, which is the very living image of kind of like the outsider's quaint pastoral New Mexico, right? And he's living in the trailer next door. I just well, on the one hand, I'm filled with, I don't think there's any other way to describe it, liberal guilt, right?
Right.
I mean, my God, I'm part of the problem. I'm not part of the solution. I'm part of the problem here. Just another, you know, writer, artist, you know, coming in just like they have been for the last 100 years, Santa Fe and Taos, representing this land, and in doing so, erasing the neighbor in the trailer, right? Or the addict next door, you know, who's going to die of a drug overdose one day. And I asked him, well, do you want to come over, you know, immediately. That was my reaction. Well, my God, it's your house, you know, please come and visit. And he looked me straight in the eye and he said, I will one day, but I'm not ready yet. And it took about 2 years for him to get ready to come in. And it was actually on the eve of our departure that he finally came over and sat down and told me his family's story on the land, and how deep it was, and his memories growing up in that house. And it was just an eerie, eerie feeling. You know, it really brought home all these historical and class tensions that just suffuse places like northern New Mexico.
We're talking to Ruben Martinez about his book, Desert America, Boom and Bust in the New Old West. So I think you said it in one place, probably around that same part of the book, that northern New Mexico was the one place you've lived in which Hispanic or Latino, however you want to say it, people have not claimed Mexican people as their siblings, but rather see them as immigrants in a more mainstream American kind of perspective. What do you see, for example, in Los Angeles in contrast to northern New Mexico in terms of those dynamics?
I don't want to make sweeping generalizations, because there's plenty of Hispanos in northern New Mexico who do see Mexican immigrants as their, you know, brothers and sisters. And I know several of them. You know, Esteban Arellano, a wonderful writer on the town of Embudo, who befriended us and received us, even though we were outsiders, with great hospitality and warmth. So I'll preface my comments by saying that. But now, back to making somewhat of a generalization, it is true that the emphasis in Hispano culture, and I'm invoking the term that many people use to describe themselves, whether norteño or Hispano, right, in northern New Mexico, tends to turn on the Iberian, the Spanish side of the equation. Whereas in the South Valley of Texas or in southern Arizona or in southern California, the border region overall, there's a fair amount of Mexican nationalism, and that Mexican nationalism translated into the Chicano movement and was a cornerstone of the Chicano movement. So that's kind of the historical backdrop of it. Northern New Mexico was always more isolated, and it's further from the border, right? And the particular experience of isolation, both from Mexico City and Spain, kind of like left, I think, the culture to have a deeper sense of the Iberian side of the equation than the Mexican over the formative centuries of you know, since basically Mexican independence. So with that backdrop, there's a little bit less of the Mexican classic, you know, Mexican nationalism that you see in other regions. And this was brought home to me, well, in many ways. I mean, it's been brought home, I think, to New Mexico in the election of Susana Martinez, for example, right, on the one hand. and her particular politics in terms of immigration, and how that resonated with a lot of Hispano voters. And when we were living up north in the Española Valley, there was in Española itself, in the city, there were a couple of murders of Mexican immigrants, small merchant owners, shop owners. And these two murders, which remain unsolved, really set the Mexican community on edge. And the rumor was that it was Hispanos that were gunning for Mexican immigrants. And this just opened a very raw wound that had been festering for quite some time, and just laid bare kind of like the big distance between these communities. It was quite painful, you know, to witness. That said, I think there's a lot of people, a lot of activists that were trying to bridge the gap between those two communities and continue to do so. And, of course, as time goes on, you know, the Mexican outsiders are going to become Mexican-American insiders across time as they speak more English and become more acculturated. So I hope it's a chapter, a dark chapter that we're leaving behind, beginning to leave behind.
You spoke a minute ago about how you are coming in to New Mexico, like innumerable other artists and writers who've come into New Mexico, and how the West, as you write in the book, has been represented in the visual arts and literature so much. How have those images of the West actually affected the history of the West?
It goes back, you know, I for the first time I was in, I'm here in Albuquerque right now, and I was in the Andalus Hotel, which was one of, I guess, the original Hilton Hotel in Albuquerque. And I'd never seen Ben Turner's mural. Ben Turner was one of the Taos, one of the early generation Taos painters. Wasn't among the very first wave, but, you know, began his career relatively, you know, early on in the Taos art colony scene. And he painted these amazing murals in the late 30s at what is today the Andalus Hotel in Albuquerque. And I was astonished by a mural painted in 1939 that already has every tourist destination in the state very well established. You know, you go see the turtle dance on New Year's Day in San Juan, now Okeowinge. You go south to see this, you go north to see that. All the tourist attractions have already been set by that time. And of course, those tourist attractions were set, were aided in great part, became tourist attractions because of the visual arts. The Atchison, Topeka, Santa Fe Railroad, you know, obviously came through New Mexico and needed paying customers to make good on the commercial promise of it. And the way the early writers were attracted through advertising in magazines was through the canvases of these master painters that were employed by the ATSF. So from early on, artists and writers are essential in bringing people out to the Southwest and to the West in general. And these representations, these are master artists, right? And there's a reason why they're in our galleries and museums today, right? They're aesthetically speaking, they're the greatest artists of their generation. But they're also seeing things through a particular lens. They're coming from outside. They're not conversant with public culture. They're not conversant, even less conversant with Hispano culture. Don't speak Spanish, have relatively little historical context. They were progressive politically, you know, within the context of their time, but their visions were also, I think, tinged by just the classic colonial, you know, racial lenses of that time. If you read D.H. Lawrence's, you know, writings from his time in Taos, I mean, you'll find all kinds of stereotypes and cliches in the racial sense about, especially about Native Americans. So, right from the beginning, I think the artists are complicit and writers are complicit in furthering the racial justifications for Manifest Destiny. And it's ironic because, of course, many of them, Charles Lummis among them and Mary Austin, you know, are considered heroes of the liberal left in many ways. But their writings also reflect the time that they were living. And they were not immune to the stereotypes and to the distortions and erasures of that era. So I think from the very beginning, the artistic gaze upon this place was contaminated by the work of empire. And that the residue of that continues to this very day. You know, you just walk into any gallery where you see, you know, a representation of a Native American riding bareback, and it's tapping into that lineage of that particular gaze of empire.
Well, the D.H. Lawrence quotes that you have in the book, which were rather shocking, I have to say. I haven't really read very much D.H. Lawrence. He writes about the Indians. You quote him, and he says that you either sentimentalize or dislike the Indians, and Lawrence seemed to do exactly that. And as I was reading it, I actually was filled with a kind of sense of hope to see how far we've come. I mean, I can't imagine any prominent writer of our time perceiving indigenous people in that way, and certainly not saying it. And there's so much more attempt, and I think some real successful attempts to allow indigenous voices in departments, in universities, and on radio, and in literature, and everywhere. What's your take on that?
I think you're absolutely right. And thanks for bringing in, you know, hope and optimism into our conversation about this. Being an academic myself, I know very well, you know, what we call cultural studies today, the cultural studies movement, basically the last generation of scholarly work on the West, beginning with Patricia Limerick and Richard White writing those wonderful books in the 80s, Limerick's Legacy of Conquest, and Richard White's work, It's No Misfortune. It's Not My Misfortune. I'm going to get the title wrong, but the one with misfortune in the title. Those works stood kind of like Western history upside down, right? And we've been revising Western history since then. I don't know how far the new Western critique has reached into the popular consciousness, though.
Right.
Because when we go to the tourist locations, it's not like there's quotes from Patricia Limerick or Richard White, you know, next to the paintings, recontextualizing them for us, which is what, you know, these historians were doing. They're saying, wait a second, you know, the West has been seen through basically John Wayne's eyes. You know, we've been that's been the gaze upon the West for the last, you know, 100 years. But everybody else is out here, too. Let's try to see it from the Native's point of view. Let's try to see it from the Hispano point of view. That was the great new Western gesture, and it's ongoing. I don't think you necessarily get that when you visit, you know, the classic destinations of the West. I think the old West is still very much alive. And one place where you see it thriving still is in real estate. Real estate, you know, the advertising, the language of advertising in real estate, the way it describes landscape, the way it describes, you know, history, is very much old Western. It's completely unreconstructed old West that drives the real estate market in that drove it certainly during the boom years, and what's left of the real estate market today tends to use those old notions of the West, you know, a whiff of Native American mysticism. Red Rock landscape, a little bit of Hispano-Romanticism thrown in, you know, and you've got the perfect thing to sell real estate to outsiders with. So I think you're absolutely right. We've taken several, you know, great leaps forward, but you've got to be a really attentive reader of history to get to that, I don't think our tourists are given that kind of legacy tourism. There's more and more of that type of tourism happening, but it hasn't really hasn't completely reversed the old Western notions.
I wish somebody would do a study of how long it takes ideas to get from the stage of theory and philosophy and academia to acceptance in the broader culture. I mean, it's a time lag of decades, if not perhaps a century in many cases.
And, you know, and it follows ideological lines, right?
Yeah.
Right now, there's still a culture war going on, And you see it in terms of, you know, Tea Party politics versus Occupy politics. I mean, there's a huge gap. And the kind of new Western, you know, vision that we're talking about in this conversation generally resides on the liberal left side of the spectrum, right? And that's why there was that vociferous, you know, reaction against Patricia Limerick when she first broke upon the scene. I mean, she's, that kind of criticism, New Western criticism, has become mainstream to the extent that, you know, when Ken Burns did his great, you know, big series on the West, Patricia Limerick was all over it. So that counts for something. But once again, who watches public TV, right? It tends to be a liberal crowd, and which is why it's always the target, you know, of the right when it comes time for funding, you know, issues. So I mean, it's a tug of war that continues. It's happening. It's happening every single day, and people have a choice. You know, whether you're selling real estate, whether you're trying to draw tourists, whether you're a roadside restaurant on a tourist route. It comes down to people making choices about how they present things. It's not just, you know, the great Taos painters, George O'Keefe or Ansel Adams. It's every single one of us and the way we represent and talk about the place that we live in. So ultimately, the responsibility is shared across all kinds of lines of race and class, because there's plenty of Hispanos or natives that play upon particular visions of the culture that they know or unselfconsciously deploy because they still sell. So, you know, it's not easy blaming just one group here. And I hope that the book ultimately says, even though we're on different sides of many lines that separate us, we are all our neighbors on this landscape. And it's up to us as neighbors to live up to the very term neighbor. You know, what does it mean to be a neighbor? What kind of responsibilities and rights come with that?
Right. Yeah, it's a complex book in the best sense of the word, and doesn't give you, as I was saying in the very beginning, doesn't give you any easy answers, doesn't give you any good guys and bad guys. And one of the things I really appreciate about this book, we're talking about Desert America, Boom and Bust in the New Old West, is that you are very honest about your own position with respect to the people and places that you're writing about and the ambivalence of that position, and willing to admit, well, this person is saying something that goes against everything that I believe, but they live here and I don't. And I guess I just want to say I really appreciate that. Right. Yeah, it's a complex book in the best sense of the word, and doesn't give you, as I was saying in the very beginning, doesn't give you any easy answers, doesn't give you any good guys and bad guys. And one of the things I really appreciate about this book, we're talking about Desert America, Boom and Bust in the New Old West, is that you are very honest about your own position with respect to the people and places that you're writing about and the ambivalence of that position, and willing to admit, this person is saying something that goes against everything that I believe, but they live here and I don't. And I guess I just want to say I really appreciate that.
Oh, thank you. I mean, I've probably mentioned Patricia Limerick's name, 10 times already in this conversation, but she's part of a generation of scholars that in cultural studies circles that basically, you know, said we all have to be really aware of our own position vis-a-vis the subjects we're writing about.
Yeah.
And so I took, you know, maybe I overdid, you know, kind of like, gazing back upon myself and my own position. Maybe I overdid it, but I would rather do that than, you know, pretend I was being objective. Because I think that believing in that kind of gaze of objectivity, I think that is really part of the big problem. You know, that's claiming something. That's claiming a kind of power that reinforces the lines that separate us.
Well, there's a great deal more to talk about, and people can go and meet Ruben Martinez tonight at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore. We didn't even talk about the border in any detail and all the very interesting stories that nobody's ever heard, you know, that are going on. So I recommend that people go tonight and that they read this book. And I want to thank you very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you so much for the thoughtful conversation.
Ruben Martinez is a journalist, performer, musician. He's a professor of writing and literature at Loyola Marymount University, and the new book is called Desert America, Boom and Bust in the New Old West. And I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Karen Rowell. She is executive director of Youth Shelters. Welcome.
Thanks for having us, Mary Charlotte. It's really nice to be here again.
It's wonderful to have you back. And Emily Folks is here. She is interim program director of the Street Outreach Program at Youth Shelters. Welcome.
Hi.
And we're going to be talking about this organization and also about the fundraiser that Youth Shelters has coming up called Boots, Bolos, and Boogie. Stay tuned at the end of the program for a little bit more about that. So this is an organization that basically helps people who might be invisible to many or most of our listeners, and that is homeless teens in Santa Fe.
In crisis, runaway, and homeless teens in Santa Fe. And that really, the age range is probably from about 11 through 22. But then we also serve homeless moms and who have babies. So we serve infants and children as well.
And so these are people who have gotten in the position that they're at where they need the kind of help that you provide, sometimes through no fault of their own, but basically, what would you call it? A troubled society.
Yes. I would call it a troubled society. I would call it a society in which the family is breaking down, and also, a time when there is so much pressure on parents to make a living, I think especially in Santa Fe where the cost of living is so high and the wages are so low. We live in a town where there's a lot of poverty, and where parents really struggle sometimes because of where they came from, where there might be generational substance abuse, intergenerational. There might be intergenerational incarceration.
Grandparents, parents, and then kids,
yes.
All addicted to whatever it is, heroin, alcohol, that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Also, where domestic violence is present, and it hasn't yet been really dealt with or explored, and also just lack of parenting skills.
And so people show up. I actually had the privilege of going over to the drop-in center where both of you were the other day, and it is really a wonderful place. And going there, one gets the sense, because of what's in there, of what is actually lacking in people's lives. What are some of the facilities that you have there?
We offer laundry facilities. We offer a kitchen, plenty of food that our youth can either eat while they're there. They can also take food with them when they go. We offer clothing, hygiene products, access to shower, bathroom. We also offer computer access, internet access for job search or for educational purposes. We offer case management, counseling referrals. We do a lot of referrals out into the community for things like healthcare or education, that type of thing.
And so the young people who come there, they really make, it looks like they really make use of those services. I mean, they're things, if a kid is homeless, something that everybody else takes for granted, like a shower and toothpaste,
exactly,
becomes something that either you provide them or they don't get them.
Right. I would say with all of our programs that what we try to do initially, whether it's in the crisis shelter, in transitional living, or in our street outreach program, is first and foremost we try and meet the emergency needs. Just as a little background, 85% of the kids that we serve at youth shelters, and last year that was about 1,129 youth and their families.
That's a lot of kids in a town this size.
Yes. You know, New Mexico is number 47 for homeless children. So there's only three other states ahead of us that have more homeless kids. We have a lot of, there is a lot of homelessness. So when young people come to us, sometimes they come to us with the clothes on their back. Whether they've been in emergency, removed from their homes and taken to the shelter, they've been, you know, abused and neglected and run away from home, or, you know, in the program that Emily runs, where they often have been out in the street or living out on the streets or very marginally housed and are looking for, you know, a starting place, which is food, shower, safety, and then, you know, kind of stabilization.
Safety, talk about that. That must be a huge part of what you guys are providing, which is both a physical and an emotional thing.
Absolutely. I think that safety is the bare essential. So that's the very first thing that we offer. We'd like to think that through either walking into our drop-in center or making contact with one of our outreach workers on the street, our clients are a little bit safer at that point.
What kinds of unsafety do they feel and do they experience when they're out on the street?
Well, like you said, there's a lot of physical and a lot of emotional insecurities. Physically, it could be anything from the weather to other people out on the streets.
Exploitation.
Exploitation.
Sexual exploitation, trading.
Is there a lot of that here?
Yeah. I mean, you know, when you think about it, and you're a vulnerable youth out on the street, you have no money, no food, and somebody comes along and offers to feed you, and all of a sudden, you know, you're making this trade of sex for food, or well, you know, if you come with me, I'll give you a place to sleep, and all of a sudden, you know, that place to sleep is sort of a compromised situation.
Absolutely.
And you know, that certainly that occurs among youth in the adult, when they mix with the adult homeless population, but you know, there's just all kinds of predators in our society. And, you know, if you're hungry and cold and looking for some place to come in out of the cold, sometimes your judgment is not that great.
Right. Absolutely. You'll sacrifice a lot just to meet those basic essentials, those basic needs.
Now, tell us a little more about the Street Outreach Program.
The Street Outreach Program is a little bit different than the other programs in that it's not a residential program. We're open from 10 to 5, Monday through Friday, and for 4 hours on Saturday. And 7 days a week, we have outreach workers go out on the street with backpacks that contain basic supplies. So that's food, water, basic first aid, some hygiene, socks, things like that. So when we first make contact with the youth on the street, it usually is out in their element, out on the street. And our outreach workers are able to, you know, offer them in a safe way things that they may need. And from there, once they establish a good relationship with them, they may refer them over to the drop-in center where they can utilize things like our washer and dryer and kitchen and internet access and shower and these type of things. So at that point, when they come in, they're given a tour of our facilities, they meet the staff, and they're just able to do whatever they need to do to take care of themselves. And should they express to us that there's more that they want to do, more than they need, than, you know, food, shower, water, at that point we can move forward with some more case management, which we've been doing a ton of. And that could be job search and exploring housing situations and the education component, working towards getting a GED, that type of thing. A lot of times it's reuniting them with their families who may be out of state. I worked with a young man who were trying to get back to the West Coast so that he can reunite with his sister, who's the only family he has left at this point. So those type of things come with time.
You know, one of the things that Emily was saying I think is really important is that when kids are ready, we really try to provide more. So our basic bottom line is safety, and whether it's in the shelter, again, street outreach, whatever. But, you know, in the past, that seemed like it was enough, you know, and then kids could kind of get it back together, and they could you know, look for some entry-level job. And with the way that employment is, with the way that our economy is as a whole, we are really concentrating on education and workforce skills. And so in every one of our programs, there is an element where once we've established that, you know, do you have enough to eat? Are you clean? Do you have clothes? You know, those basic necessities. We're doing a lot of work with getting kids back on track with their with a GED. We have kids that have gone to college. Last year, we had five kids graduate from either the high school, SER Academy, or GED. We had two or three kids in college, and we had about 12 kids in process of completing their GED. And it makes a tremendous difference to them being able to then motivate and move themselves on to where they are moving on to safe and stable living situations.
One of the things that I think is really important to talk about and probably hard to deal with is the fact that when kids have a lifelong history of, let's say, substance abuse or violent abuse or just neglect or whatever those things are in their families, A, that's the norm for them, right. And B, it's the habit. It's like, how do you change out of something where really that's all you know into something that's unfamiliar and not really, oh, that's the way those people are, that's not the way we are. Like, how do you change that?
Time. You know, it takes time. And, you know, one of the things that is, I don't know, Emily, if you have the same experience, but my experience has been, I've been in and out of youth shelter since 1995, is that for a lot of kids where a kind of a predictable home environment is pretty unusual, that, you know, by working with them and sort of setting some parameters, setting some limits, doing some modeling, they come to know and to appreciate that kind of predictability, that you can, in fact, have a safe place to do your homework, to get something to eat, and no one's going to come in here and hurt you. You start to see kids relaxing and moving into it and accepting that change in the environment.
Absolutely. And we had talked a little bit last week about how they really have to be ready to do that too. At least a lot of the kids that we see at Outreach, like I said, they're in there to meet their basic needs. And once they know that those needs can be met through us being there consistently, and then sometimes they're able to get to a point where they decide they want to work on something else, where they decide they want to work on their GED or their job search or whatever. But we kind of have to fill that gap in the meantime to get them from the point of survival mode of just being able to, I need to brush my teeth, take a shower, I need some food, into, okay, I've met these needs, and now I'm ready to start working towards something else. And they do. They depend on us to be there and be stable for them throughout the entire process.
And I think some of that is that they're testing us.
Oh, absolutely.
See, you know, are we really going to be there?
Absolutely.
And you so know, consistency is the absolute bottom line that you guys have to provide.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, our crisis shelter out at the end of Agua Fria, we'll have young people come because maybe they've been removed from their home or they run away because it wasn't safe there. And they will come back, you know, several times, you know, whether they've run away from that situation again or they've been removed again. And then, of course, they age out when they're 18. And they can sometimes be eligible to go and live in our housing, in our apartments and transitional living. And if not, they find us another safe place to go. And then years later, they will come back and knock on the door. And you know, we even have some people who have come back to volunteer and work for us who have said, I would not be here if it hadn't been for this shelter. And now I'm ready to give something back.
In the last segment, we talked to Ruben Martinez, who was talking about the importance of thinking of ourselves all as neighbors, no matter what our demographics are, no matter what our race or class or means or where we live or age or any of that stuff. We're all neighbors. And I think that it's really important for all of us, for me, for everybody listening, to realize that these young people are our neighbors and that we're all in the same system, the economic system that creates prosperity for some, huge abundant wealth for others, struggling to survive but surviving for others, and completely falling through the cracks. It's one system. It's all the
same
thing. It
is. And, you know, you can be in one place today, and in 2 weeks, your situation can totally change. And the thing about these young kids is that, you know, they can come from a prosperous, affluent household that comes apart at the seams and be, you know, without anything.
Yeah.
And they have so much, there are resources for our community. And so in some ways, they are, you know, yes, they are our neighbors, but they are the potential of the future of this town.
Right.
And we have to value them and be there for them and try and be partners with them to change their destiny. Because they are who is going to be running Santa Fe in the next 10 or 15 years.
And if they're not running it, they might be draining it.
Exactly. Or well, yeah, that's right.
So you are having a fundraiser very soon, the Tuesday, the 21st of August at 5:30 at Las Campanas.
Right.
And it's called Boots, Bolos, and Boogie.
That is correct.
That sounds like fun.
It's going to be really fun. It's a group of volunteers came together, really led by someone in the community who has met our kids and said, oh my gosh, we have to do something about it. We have to educate people that there are homeless youth. And of course, being a nonprofit, we always are ready for a fundraiser. So it'll be an evening with Jimmy Gilmer and the Fireballs, whose big song was Sugar Shack. there's a live auction for some wonderful, a house in Scottsdale, Arizona, and one in Idaho, a beautiful diamond necklace.
Like a vacation.
Yes,
kind of
yes. So people can get their friends together. They can find out about it by going to youshelters.org. It's on our website, and it should be a really fun evening.
And encouraging everybody to come from, again, all our neighbors from all sectors of the community.
Yes, because, you know, that's right. We are neighbors, and these are our kids.
And in addition to the live auction, there's also a silent auction. And for more information, youthshelters.org or call 505-983-0586. You can ask for Aaron. Karen Rowell is Executive Director of Youth Shelters. Emily Folks is Interim Program Director of the Street Outreach Program. Once again, youthshelters.org and the Boots, Bolos, and Boogie, Tuesday, August 21st at 5:30 at Las Campanas. We will see you there. Thank you so much for being with us, and thank you so much for what you do in this world.
Oh, thank you for letting us spread the word.
Thanks.